From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, breaking down the results of the party primaries, there were some surprises, and for others, it was just another day at the office. And the state of hate in Texas. The Southern Poverty Law Center says it's getting leaner and meaner. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tuesday was primary day in Texas, the first in the nation, and a kickoff for the 2014 election season. The two top candidates looking for party nominations for governor, Republican Greg Abbott and Democrat Wendy Davis, had their expected solid wins. But the further you look down ballot, the murkier the takeaway becomes. The GOP is left with multiple runoffs and mixed messages about the political leanings of the state. But the editor of the Quorum Report, Harvey Kronberg, says the election results counter any predictions of a downswing for the Texas Tea Party.
The combination of Tea Party with adequate funding proved decisive for Lieutenant Governor candidate Dan Patrick and Attorney General candidate Ken Paxton. Now, the further down the ballot you go, the less clear it becomes. The Tea Party was a willing pool of voters, and if you had enough money to reach them, it could be significant.
So 5 years into the Tea Party's lifespan, and in Texas, they are still kicking.
On a statewide level, in a Republican primary, yes. The business community, which is the kind of the antithesis of the Tea Party, has made noise as if it were going to try and mount an effort, much as some of the national organizations have done, to defeat Tea Party candidates and compete financially with them. But so far, that's the most likely group to be able to neutralize them, and they really haven't crystallized yet.
Well, some of the national media looking at Texas primary, and they're getting it all wrong. They're saying that the Texas Tea Party, the quote-unquote, the best days may be behind it. That's from Politico trying to figure out what happened with John Cornyn and Stockman.
Correct. Well, they were looking at two races, and they were both national races. One was Cornyn-Stockton, the other was Sessions and Katrina Pearson. And in both cases, you had very, very flawed challengers. With no money, and in fact, they were so embarrassing that Tea Party folks distanced themselves from them. I don't know how much longer Tea Party candidates are going to be decisive. What I do think is that, or that they're even going to be significant, what I do think is midterm elections are generally lower turnout affairs. This election, for all the Tea Party heat that was involved in it, was 200,000 to 300,000 fewer people voting than voted in the Republican primary in the last midterm in 2010.
What do we know now about what a future Texas House is going to look like based upon how this primary shaked out?
Well, and there it is, probably the most interesting question of the evening, because at the top of the ticket, the Tea Party gave Dan Patrick and Ken Paxton kind of breathtaking margins. But when you got further down ballot to House race, it was essentially Speaker Strauss and his team fighting back the Tea Party folks. And generally speaking, both of them had a triumph. So it was essentially a wash. The House is going to be conservative, but it's going to be more driven by problem solving because its leader, Joe Strauss, is much less ideological and actually wants to get some things done. And he has successfully, over the last several years or sessions, learned how to take freshmen who come in a very ideological and have them mentor with senior members to show them the ropes so that they have a different echo chamber than just the standard old Tea Party echo chamber.
So let's look at some of these races in the primary. I got to hang out at Greg Abbott's campaign party. Watch party on primary night, and it was pretty subdued. You know, they took it in stride. Nobody was too excited. It's like this is happening right according to plan.
Yeah, in fact, the only reason to have a watch party was because it gave TV cameras something, some visuals that they could run through the course of the evening about in case the night went on. General Abbott, spoke for 6 or 7 minutes and maybe the most conciliatory, modulated speech he's given in the entire primary season.
I was stunned at how little there was in his speech on his big night of clinching the nomination, and it was pretty much exactly what he has been saying since the day that he announced that he was running for governor. It was the same speech, so nothing new. They're not going to change anything, and they're going to run a very conservative, by the books, take no risk type of campaign.
Yes, but there was one significant change in the fact that we weren't talking about shutting down the border. He had a long segment in the speech where he's talking about if you're here to make a better life, improve yourself, compete, then you are welcome. The blending of cultures in Texas works. Now, he didn't say anything about immigration or any of those kinds of issues, but what he did was cast a much more welcoming tone to Hispanic voters than, say, his likely lieutenant governor running mate has been doing for the last 6 months.
But looking at Wendy Davis, people are trying to make something of the fact that she lost some border counties to a Ray Madrigal, who is from Corpus Christi.
Hispanic surname south of I-10 obviously has an advantage. We saw Victor Morales actually become a United States Senate candidate based solely on his surname in a Democratic primary. It is noteworthy only because, in my opinion, because it shows the failing of so far of the much vaunted battleground Texas, which is supposed to be registering, turning voters out, and getting them on the program.
So people are trying to, particularly the conservative media, trying to make something of the fact that Wendy Davis lost those counties, showing that there's weakness in the campaign on her side, that she can't even get a solid. She got, 75% of the vote, but she didn't do 91.5% of the vote like Greg Abbott.
Right, right. Well, and in those counties, she dramatically overperformed Greg Abbott. Even if she lost them, her numbers were still better than Greg Abbott's numbers in those counties. So, but having said that, it's a minor episode. It gives the Republicans a talking point. Once again, demonstrates that the Davis organization is not yet even close to being a mature organization. Hell, what I heard out of the Davis campaign is they had no clue that there was a problem in South Texas.
The other thing people are trying to make some hay out of is that there were 20 counties in Texas in which there were no Democrat votes at all. The story that's being passed around says 22, but I went through the Secretary of State's office and looked through it myself, and it was just 20, but still, that's a lot.
Yes, well, those counties weren't going to have Democratic state reps or senators anyway. The pool of Democratic voters that Wendy Davis has to look at are going to be urban. Urban counties, suburban counties, and rural counties are the ones that don't have any Democratic voters, and they don't add up to enough votes to make a difference typically in a statewide election anyway.
Yeah, these are counties like McMullen County in South Texas, where it's only like 900 registered voters
right. Anyway.
And I don't even think they had a Democratic primary there. If you wanted to vote in that county, I don't think you would have had a hard time doing so. But and there were 8 counties in the state in which there were no Republican votes cast.
Oh, well, that's interesting, too. That I did not know. The bulk of Republican voters are in the suburbs. The bulk of the Democratic voters are in the metropolitan areas. They're going to both try and reach into the strongholds of the other side to shake some votes loose. But that's a simple reality.
The race people were watching on primary night was the lieutenant governor's race for the Republican nomination. That's going to be a runoff between Dan Patrick, the radio talk show host, Texas senator, and David Dewhurst, the millionaire incumbent.
That is correct.
So it's kind of a repeat of what we had with Ted Cruz?
It looks like it. Conventional wisdom, which some of us doubted but proved to be correct, was that David Dewhurst was known by 90% of Republican primary voters and had 70-75% disapproval rating. There was some polling that came out a month or so ago that showed his approval was going up dramatically. He did not go negative on Patrick, so Patrick was left, with the exception of a few news stories, was generally left to define himself. He went up early in the metropolitan area, the Metroplex, where they don't know him very well, focused predominantly on Fox News, kind of the town hall meeting of Republican primary voters. and introduced himself. And then you add to that, in Harris County, where he is a very well-known factor, there were, as best I can tell, 27,000 voters that went to the polls, voted only for Dan Patrick, and then left. Didn't vote for anybody else on the ballot.
Harvey Kronberg is the editor of The Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics. It's online at quorumreport.com. Since its founding in 1971, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been at the center of the nation's struggle against hate groups. The nonprofit SPLC is noted for its many legal victories against mainly white supremacist organizations and its cataloging of hate groups with its Year in Hate report. This year, the report finds, after a multi-year spike in the number of hate groups, there is a reduction in the number of those hate groups, but that doesn't mean that there is a reduction in hate. That's according to Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and the editor-in-chief of its quarterly journal, Intelligence Report, and its Hate Watch blog.
We count groups on the radical right and have been doing so for more than 30 years. It's the best way we know to get some kind of sense of what's really going on out there on the extreme right in terms of the size of the movement. Is it growing? Is it shrinking? And so on. So our latest report found something quite remarkable, which was that after 4 years of really spectacular growth, for the first time, the groups have started to diminish. Hate groups by some 7% by our count. And so-called patriot groups, so groups we all used to refer to as militias, by almost 20%, by 19%.
But you also point out that the groups are getting leaner and meaner. What do you mean by meaner?
Well, what we mean is what seems to be happening is as some of the groups have become disillusioned, they've lost a lot of wind with the reelection of Barack Obama, that moderates, the people who are less committed to sort of radical ideas and so on, have dropped away. And so we've been left with essentially a harder core, if a smaller one, of activists within these groups. And I think that that is reflected in the fact that even though the groups are going down, it does not seem that the level of terrorism or attempted terrorism from these domestic groups has diminished.
So let's get back to your original point about that there is a drop-off in the number of groups and in the number of membership in the groups. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are really a whole set of things we think going on. We think that the initial growth of these groups, which began in 2009, was closely tied to the election of Barack Obama, our first black president. Very large numbers of people seem to react viscerally to the idea of a black man in the White House. And perhaps even more so to the demographic change in the country that he represents, the idea that as America is slated to lose its white majority in the next 30 years or so. So that drove the initial very rapid rise in these groups. Now, perhaps counterintuitively, I think his reelection has worked in the opposite direction. I think these groups feel, along with much of the more mainstream political right, that they have worked and worked and worked and made clear that Barack Obama is a real demon, is destroying the country, and so on. And yet he was elected. And yet same-sex marriage advances. And yet health care reform, if off to a rocky start, nevertheless has gotten started. So I think that there's a kind of deflation, a demoralization among many of these groups that have caused people, as I said earlier, the moderates in particular, to really walk away in a dispirited mood. There are other things going on as well. The economy obviously has improved, although it's certainly not terrific. We've also seen a fairly major crackdown on the part of law enforcement on a number of different sectors of the radical right. That's been, I think, quite clear in the last 2 or 3 years. Some of the groups have collapsed purely for their own internal reasons, very weak leadership, squabbles, and so on among members. And then I think another factor is the idea that many of the radical causes that these groups champion have, in fact, moved into state legislatures and to some extent Congress as well. To give you a sense of what I'm talking about, the idea that Sharia law, that Islamic religious law, could be imposed on American courts is entirely bogus. That is not possible under the American Constitution. For years, despite that, small groups on the extreme left pressed this idea that Sharia law would be imposed on our courts and we would all be essentially slaves to Muslim religious ideas. Well, you know, in the last few years, we have seen seven states actually pass those laws. So there are a number of other examples, these nullification laws, states passing laws saying, for instance, that federal gun control laws don't apply in my state, that kind of thing. Has also been taken up by state legislatures and quite a few of them. So I think all of this together has essentially taken the wind out of the sails of much of the extreme right, or at least slowed them down to some extent.
So you're saying that some of these extreme groups may be losing membership or losing momentum because some of their ideas that propelled them in the past are actually moving into the mainstream?
That's right. So what I'm arguing is that it's not such a rosy picture out there. The groups have diminished, but their ideas in large part have moved into the political mainstream. And there's another aspect of why I think the danger from the groups is still fairly high, and that is the fact that despite the reduction in the number of groups over the last year or so, we still have over 2,000 groups on the radical right, when you count hate groups and militia groups together. That number is almost twice as high as the previous peak, which occurred back in 1996 at the kind of height of the first wave of the militia movement. So there are a lot of groups out there. There are a lot of angry people. Obviously, I think political polarization in this country generally continues at very high levels. So I think, in fact, the danger, at least in terms of violence from these groups, has not gone down much.
So a lot of folks out there, they're kind of feeling the walls closing in on them because they're losing these culture wars with marijuana legalization and same-sex marriage. So they're reacting that way. But it's interesting about how the mainstream seems to be adopting some of the views from these extreme groups. It used to be you would never hear anyone talking about, let's totally shut down the IRS or let's take over the government. You see mainstream politicians who are actually involved with people who are calling for an overthrow of the United States.
That's absolutely right. It's quite common to hear politicians now saying we may have to take up arms. I wrote in my essay, looking at the last year in hate and extremism, about a particular poll that was taken about this time last year, in spring 2013, by Fairleigh Dickinson University. And what it found, incredibly enough, was that 29% of Americans feel that armed rebellion against the government may be necessary in the next few years. I have to say I find that kind of shocking.
Let's talk about Texas a little bit. It's listed as the top six states for hate groups. You've got California, Texas, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and New Jersey. So how do you determine what's a hate group?
We base our counts of hate groups on their ideology. What hate groups, at least in our definition, are not, the definition of a hate group is not, is something based on criminality or some kind of estimate we're making as to the potential for violence. It's all about ideology. Does a group in its platform statements, on its website, in the speeches of its leader, say that an entire group of human beings, based on their group characteristics, is somehow less? In other words, does the group say all white people are blue-eyed devils, all black people are criminals, all the Jews are, you know, evil moneylenders, or whatever it may be? It's those kinds of characterizations that get them on our list.
So what we used to call militia groups back in the days of Bo Gritz and those people, you call them patriot groups now. Why the change?
Well, that's really what they call themselves. And back in the 90s, they called themselves the same thing. Sometimes they used the phrase Christian patriot groups. It just seems like a more accurate phrase because really, at least in our typology, the militias are the kind of armed groups within the patriot movement. There are many groups that embrace the ideas of the patriot movement that don't go out into the woods and train on weekends and do that kind of thing. The militia groups, which, as I say, are a subset of the larger movement, actually do go out and train with weapons.
Well, there have been some folks who have pushed back against you and Southern Poverty Law Center and your reports saying that you are trying to demonize patriot groups, and they don't give you the definition of that, and they make it seem like they're just, you know, like a Tea Party type people. They have their political views, but they're not trying to do anything dangerous.
Well, obviously, most people in the groups are not criminals. They're not trying to blow up federal buildings or murder police officers, and we certainly don't allege that. On the other hand, they are not the same as the Tea Party groups. There's a bit of overlap, but they really are quite different. I think the Tea Party groups are essentially economically populist groups on the right. The patriot groups, the militia groups, generally share a conspiracy theory which absolutely groundlessly demonizes the federal government, and in a very scary way. The conspiracy theory differs from group to group and even individual to individual somewhat, but it basically goes like this. They believe that the federal government is involved in a plot to impose martial law at any moment on this country, that martial law will be imposed with the help of foreign troops, very likely UN blue helmets, that next the federal government will seize weapons from all American citizens, all people who are not a part of the government, and that those who resist will be thrown into concentration camps that have been secretly built by the Federal Emergency Management Agency over the last several years. And ultimately, or so the conspiracy theory goes, the object is to push the United States into some kind of socialistic one-world government, often called the New World Order.
You're listening to Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're speaking with Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's talking about the Year in Hate report. Looking at Texas, you say there are 67 active patriot groups in the state of Texas. Does that include these sovereign citizens?
It does to a small extent. The sovereign citizens are a part of the patriot movement. Let me say for our listeners that sovereign citizens generally are people who believe that federal laws, criminal laws, and tax laws in particular do not apply to them. They also believe that the authorities have no right to require them to use driver's licenses and auto registrations and so on.
Well, that sounds pretty, you know, like they could get in trouble with the law, but innocuous. But actually, these folks can be very dangerous.
That's right. It sounds innocuous, but we've seen quite a bit of violence out of the movement. And typically it happens when sovereign citizens, so-called, are pulled over in traffic stops. A pretty hefty percentage of them are infuriated by that, really do deeply believe that the police have absolutely no authority to do that. And we've seen a fairly large number of shootings involving police officers and sovereign citizens on the sides of roads. The most infamous case was in May 20th of 2010, when two police officers in West Memphis, Arkansas, were murdered by a father and son kind of team of sovereigns. It was really quite horrible. This pair really executed the officers, chased them down around their car with heavy weapons and murdered them. So that got the attention of the federal government in a big way. What I wanted to say earlier, though, about sovereign citizens is that they don't tend to be organized in groups. So it is much more difficult to count them because it's really a movement of people who generally aren't associated with any particular named group.
Yeah, but I also want to mention here that there are some telltale signs of a sovereign citizen, like these sort of homemade license plates, maybe some bumper stickers declaring that they are follow the common law and they have not given up any of their rights. And so if a police officer or anyone comes across one of these people in the course of doing their duty, they need to be extra careful.
That's right. And there's been trouble at courthouses, too. The sovereign citizens often file just unbelievable amounts of documents in very bizarre cases, for instance, where they say zoning doesn't apply to their home. There's even been violence over the years directed at court officials, court clerks, who, for instance, would not file sovereign citizen documents, that sort of thing. So it's really very widespread. We've seen evidence of sovereign citizens operating in literally all 50 states. It's been quite something to watch.
So again, back to the main point of your report is that we've seen a drop off in the number of these groups after a huge growth after the election of Barack Obama. Could this be the quiet before the storm?
It's incredibly hard, of course, to predict the future. But I will say this. I think, you know, it is quite possible that the movement is starting to diminish. I think what we're really looking at historically is a kind of backlash against a large number of things, against the browning of the country, of the population, against the kinds of cultural and political changes we've discussed a little bit today. You know, what that suggests is that we've seen backlashes like this throughout our history, after the civil rights movement, after the gay rights movement, after the slaves were freed, those kinds of things all produced backlashes, but the backlashes passed ultimately. So I think that we could be going into a quieter time now. It could be that during the rest of this year we see the groups continue to diminish. I think that one thing that could push it back in the other direction, that could push the groups to expand again rather rapidly, is if once again either gun control or comprehensive immigration reform really move to the fore in terms of national legislation. That doesn't seem very likely. But it is possible, and I think the groups would probably react with quite a lot of vigor if that were to happen.
But we continue to see the demographic shift on the whole as a large, in Texas particularly, as you know, we see a rising Latino demographic, and as the political power shifts as well, I guess you're going to see maybe a hardening of the of these groups who will be opposed to that.
Well, yes, that's probably true. On the other hand, the groups will be more and more marginalized as that change occurs. Texas, of course, along with three other states, is a state that has already lost its white majority, and so in a sense is a kind of harbinger of the future, California being the other big state that's gone through the same change. And it's true that political changes happen along with these demographic changes. 15 years ago, it was quite possible and, in fact, fairly easy to elect someone like Pete Wilson, governor of California. Pete Wilson, who often kind of railed on about the evils of immigrants, and in particular immigrants from the South. That, I think, is really no longer possible politically.
But we are seeing that type of rhetoric happening in the Texas primaries now, particularly in the lieutenant governor's race. So and in agriculture commissioner and land commissioner, all these offices seems to be about talking about border protection and the invasion from Mexico that's happening. So it's back in the mainstream.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the fact that Texas has lost its white majority does not mean that everything changes all at once. I mean,
yes, because that's the white majority, but it's not the majority of
voters. Right. That's exactly what I was going to say, is that, you know, it doesn't instantly change. And you have different voting rates for different population groups. And clearly, Anglos are still voting at higher rates than Latinos in Texas. And clearly, there are people in Texas who do not like the change they are seeing. And thus you get still these fairly strong anti-immigration movements and so on.
Mark Potok is a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor-in-chief of Intelligence Report, the SPLC's quarterly journal. He also writes the Hate Watch blog. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to Texas Matters with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. You could also find them on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.